America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day that commemorates what has been called the day that did not end. That would be September 11th, not September 10th, but September 11th of 2001. We will be honoring that day. We're going to be speaking to a couple of the unsung heroes of September 11th, people who, a medical doctor, a military physician, who rushed to the Pentagon and rescued people who were dying, who were being burned out of windows, who had every imaginable kind of horror at the Pentagon, not at the World Trade Center. We'll be speaking with two brothers who have written a remarkable new book about what that Pentagon attack really meant. We will also be speaking to Alan Dershowitz, who talks about the new impeachment fever. He dealt with the old impeachment fever against Donald Trump, defending Donald Trump in impeachment proceedings twice. And now there are people who want to see the impeachment of Joe Biden, if not for the shameful and disgraceful outcome in Afghanistan and President Biden's handling of it, well, then for his new attempt to impose vaccine mandates on just about everybody in America who works. Is that grounds for impeachment? We'll be speaking about that with Alan Dershowitz. We'll also be speaking with Andrew McCarthy about continued efforts to go after terrorists in the legal system. Not with the military necessarily, but with prosecutions and investigations. Did we go too far in that regard? And speaking about going too far, we'll be speaking with a medical director for infectious disease at one of the nation's most prestigious hospitals in one of the states that is being very hard pressed for the dealing with people who are, including children, by the way, who are suddenly contracting COVID-19 and particularly the Delta variant. So what do we do about this? If there is not to be some kind of massive nationwide mandate compelling inoculation, what's the way out from this particular pandemic and how we are dealing with it? We will be speaking with Dr. Francis Rito of Evergreen Health coming up on The Medved Show. First up, just a little bit about September 11th, because one of the things that people are saying, it seems to be contradictory in a way, because you have people who are saying that, look, and I wrote about this in Newsweek 2 weeks ago, that as we approach September 11th, and you think about how unified America seemed to be at the very beginning of the reaction to September 11th and the terrorist attacks, there's a sad contrast with the way that America has responded from the beginning to the pandemic. And of course, the pandemic has taken incalculably more lives. We're talking about close to 650,000 people now who have died of the pandemic. That's over a period of time. But just to put it in another context, today in the United States, we're losing 1,500 people a day. Today, we'll lose at least another 1,500 people who will die to COVID-19. Now, that means that every single 48 hours, we will be losing the same number of people that we lost on 9/11. We lost 3,000 people on 9/11. We'll lose 3,000 people in September 11th and September 10th of 2021. And yet the idea of coming together, of Americans needing to do something, there were literally tens of thousands of Americans who enlisted in the military to help protect our country after that devastating attack. Remember Pat Tillman, the football player, professional football player, interrupted his career. And there were people in all lines of work and in every field of endeavor who rushed to the colors. That was what people used to say, who decided they had to do something. What happened to that? Did anyone in equivalent rush to the colors when we began to face this devastating impact of the pandemic? Where you talk about the number of people who died in Vietnam, in Korea, in the war in Iraq, the first war in Iraq, the second war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, all of our recent battles and wars combined. In fact, you could even add on World War II. We lost 400,000 people in World War II. We're well over 600,000 now with the pandemic. And even adding on, again, Korea, which is 38,000, and Vietnam, which is 55,000, we have lost more people in this pandemic than all of our recent wars. And yet there doesn't seem to be any consensus or resolution of, okay, we're going to work together, we're going to come together, we're going to stop sniping at each other, we're going to stop arguing with each other. That was the one thing that I disliked most about President Biden's speech yesterday, is that passage where he said, look, we're losing our patience, we're just about out of patience with you. And in other words, it's dividing Americans at a time when we need to be united to try to come together to do something about this particular crisis. And frankly, I think there's a lot that we can learn, and it's part of what I want to concentrate on today, a lot that we can learn from our experience on September 11th. There is one thing that we also should learn, which is how idiotic and pathetic conspiracy theories are. There's a piece in the Washington Post that says the facts of September 11, 2001 are not contested. Terrorists hijacked four airliners. They flew two of them into the World Trade Center and one into the Pentagon, while passengers on the fourth plane helped crash it in Pennsylvania. After the attacks, conspiracy theories spread quickly. By the middle of George Bush's presidency, which was about 3 years later, a third of the public either believed that the U.S. government assisted in the attacks or took no action to avert them. Today, 9/11 conspiracy theories remain widespread. One in six Americans think Bush administration officials knew about the attacks and intentionally let them happen so they could wage war in the Middle East. Others go further, arguing that the government planned and executed the attacks. These groundless theories, commonly known as trutherism, raise important questions. How does a conspiracy theory take hold? And why, 20 years after the attack, does it endure? And they cite in this article in the Washington Post, Mark Fenster, who's a University of Florida legal scholar, who said the truthers initially were a mix of everyday conspiracy theorists who tend to believe any number of dark narratives and liberals who distrusted Bush. Not even the release of the 585-page report of the bipartisan 9/11 Commission detailing the intelligence failures that led to the attack slowed the movement. In a variety of polls in the first decade after 9/11, Democrats were more likely than Republicans to believe in trutherism. Now, it's Republicans who are more likely to believe in trutherism, who are more likely to believe in every form of conspiracy theory, including some of the conspiracy theories about COVID-19. We will get to that. First off, we're going to speak to a columnist whose work I respect greatly. He wrote the best, most powerful, unforgettable single column about 9/11. His name is Leonard Pitts. He writes for the Miami Herald. He has a new column about what's happened to us since 9/11. We'll get to that coming up on the Medved Show. on the Michael Medved show, President Biden gave a very controversial speech yesterday announcing his new program of vaccines. Among the most controversial parts of it, and the part that I found most troubling, was the idea of classifying Americans into two groups, emphasizing our differences rather than our commonalities. The whole idea of trying to get as many people vaccinated as possible is to promote the general welfare, to get people safer altogether, and to put people on a more common footing in this country. And this is part of what President Biden said yesterday that created the some of the many, many objections to his speech. This is clip five.
Even as the Delta variant COVID-19 has been hitting this country hard, we have the tools to combat the virus. If we can come together as a country and use those tools, if we raise our vaccination rate, protect ourselves and others with masking, expanded testing, and identify people who are infected, we can and we will turn the tide on COVID-19. It'll take a lot of hard work. It's going to take some time. Many of us are frustrated with the nearly 80 million Americans who are still not vaccinated, even though the vaccine is safe, effective, and free.
Okay, and then President Biden went on to say, we've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin. And your refusal has cost all of us. To create an us and them binary, where either you're with us. I mean, one of the things that President Bush was criticized for 20 years ago was saying you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. What he was talking about was the Bush Doctrine, and the Bush Doctrine was very important, and frankly, it was very important in keeping us all safe. The Bush Doctrine said, look, if you help the terrorists or shelter the terrorists or support the terrorists, we assume you are with the terrorists, and we invited the nations of the world to be with us. And for the very most part, they were. But the idea of equating people who have been hesitant to get a vaccine or have refused to get a vaccine or for various reasons maybe can't get a vaccine or maybe it's medically not recommended for them, to suggest that all 80 million people who are in that situation are having patience wear thin and saying that your refusal has cost all of us. Look, I do agree with that. Somebody wrote in and said, I can't believe you said that my getting a vaccine was your business. And I don't think I said it in quite those ways, but I could have. Because, yes, it is my business because I and people in my family and other Americans are all exposed to you. We don't live in little, like, Truman Show bubbles somewhere where you're isolated from people. We tend to be together with other people. And, again, this was something that we seem to have a better sense of back in September 11th. And this is why it's disappointing that President Biden just emotionally and rhetorically went in the direction that he did. Because one of the things that would have made a difference in this entire pandemic would have been if both President Trump and President Biden had tried to reach for bipartisanship at the very beginning of the pandemic, or certainly at the very beginning of President Biden's term. And we happen to have all kinds of former presidents who you can mobilize. Do you remember one of the things that President Obama did, and he may not have initiated it, but it was smart, was there was a disastrous earthquake, another one, this is way before, back in the Obama administration, in Haiti. And I believe they both volunteered, but President Bush and President Clinton, one president Republican, one president Democrat, they had run against each other. And Bill Clinton had run a very tough and nasty campaign against George Herbert Walker Bush. And the Bush family resented him for it, but it didn't matter. there was a public need here, and people could rise together and come together and raise money together and bring supplies together to Haiti. And it also ended up that Bush and Clinton, that's President George Herbert Walker Bush, first President Bush, and President Clinton, ended up creating, forging a genuine friendship where they actually socialized together, enjoyed each other's company. Imagine that. But again, to not do that with some of the very distinguished former Americans who would care about urging people to do the right thing, to follow social distancing and masking, and most importantly of all, vaccines when they came out. I mean, you could have even appealed to President Trump if President Biden had wanted to, if he wanted to be smart, and appealed to his ego, which is not insubstantial, and said, look, you can have the chance to go out there and talk about these vaccines that you helped develop. You actually, one of the biggest triumphs of your administration, and President Biden could easily acknowledge that, was putting together these vaccines. This is not some kind of left-wing conspiracy. If anything, it was a conspiracy to save lives, and it succeeded in saving lives. So why not that tone? Because it is difficult. I mean, President Biden said we're losing patience. There's a Republican governor who's clearly losing patience. Listen, this is the exasperated governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice, as the state hits record highs for ICU patients. Listen, this is Jim Justice, governor of West Virginia.
We now have 24,532 active cases. A bunch of them will die. We're at an all-time record for patients in the ICU, 252 patients in the ICU. All-time record. All-time record for patients on ventilators. 141 of them are on ventilators. For the most part, our entire state's red.
And the one point he is trying to stress is get vaccinated. In their response to September 11th, it was join the army. Then people made fun of President Bush. He said, look, you can help our economy by going shopping. But basically, people were expecting to make much greater sacrifices. Do you remember people grumbled a bit when they instituted the TSA and all of a sudden you had to wait in sometimes very long, very frustrating lines at airports when you were checking in your luggage? Anybody look back at that and think, oh boy, that's outrageous. What a terrible mistake. No, the TSA was a tremendous triumph. It has prevented us from having another hijacking nightmare in this country. God willing, knock on wood, we won't have any more. And by the way, there's a powerful column today by Joe Lieberman, who was one of the people when he was a U.S. senator who helped to create the Transportation Security Administration and the Department of Homeland Security. We will get to more of that. We'll also talk to Leonard Pitts, who wrote a message to the terrorists. What's the message now? Coming up on the MedVed Show. On September 11th, actually it was September 12th, this column appeared. Leonard Pitts of the Miami Herald, Pulitzer Prize winner, much decorated writer of commentary and history, really, wrote this. He wrote a message to the terrorists who hadn't even been fully identified at that time. He wrote, "Still, I keep wondering what it was you hoped to teach us. It occurs to me that maybe you just wanted us to know the depths of your hatred. If that's the case, consider the message received. And take this message in exchange," wrote Leonard Pitts. "You don't know my people. You don't know what we're about. You don't know what you just started. But you're about to learn." Leonard, do you... do you think that the terrorists learned any important messages over the last 20 years?
Yeah, I would suppose it. Certainly Osama bin Laden did when the bullets riddled his body. What I'm at a loss to figure out, frankly, since then is how much good came out of any of it, even out of the lessons that they learned. I think one of the defining features of being a terrorist, i.e. a fanatic, is the inability to learn from experience. So, I think they learned, but the question I would ask is even having learned, how much of their behavior did it really change?
There's a piece today by Condoleezza Rice, and I want to get to your piece in a moment, in the Wall Street Journal. The headline is, "We Are More Secure Than We Were on 9/11," and she talks about the entire security apparatus from the Department of Homeland Security to the TSA to elements of our foreign policy, our CIA. We are now monitoring terrorism and have counter-terror exercises and activities all over the Middle East and East Asia, East Africa. Do you think that's generally a good thing, that we are now more cautious, more concerned about suppressing major terrorist attacks before they occur?
Well, I'll tell you. During the time of 9/11, one of the things that I remember, one of the generals, I forget who it was, but one of the generals said that the problem is that we're always fighting the last war. We're always preparing for the last bad thing that happened. So while I have no doubt that we are more, resolved and more secure, perhaps, against terrorism that comes from Muslim extremists in the Middle East, we've seen a whole new terrorism problem arise in this country in the 20 years since then that I think we've been very, very slow to pay attention to. So, in other words, we're looking back at 9/11 and securing ourselves against 9/11, which is all well and good, but we were so focused on that 1/6 came upon us, and it was like something that dropped out of the sky. Nobody, seemed to have even thought it possible, which, frankly, was the same mistake, the same failure of imagination that allowed 9/11 to happen.
You know what's shocking to me? I mean, you brought it up, Leonard, but you know probably that the same folks who originally sponsored the January 6th riot on the Capitol building, they're coming back to Washington on the 18th of this month.
Yep. 9/18. I have no idea what that deal is supposed to be. I know that I'll be far away from the Capitol, but definitely in front of my television to see what happens. And again, I doubt we'll see a replay because again, they're ready for it. The security forces are ready for it. We're again fighting the last battle instead, perhaps, of trying to see around corners and try to figure out what the next battle is going to be.
Well, I hope so. I know that the Associated Press has covered some streams in the internet by people preparing for this, and they are aiming to seek revenge against corrupt Jews and Jewish congregations in Washington, D.C., which is a little bit concerning, I would think. And in any event, it's your piece today is powerful. And you say September 11th attacks led Americans to undermine democracy. Now, I'm not sure I would agree with every one of your laundry list items, but you're talking about some of the excesses that were involved in the war on terror and the war in Iraq in particular. And what you write here at the end, and you write so beautifully, you'll pardon me for reading it, but we have become a nation of truths stranger than fiction, a nation where satire must run to keep up with reality. As we go forward from this moment, we find ourselves contending for the very soul of America, something none of us could have imagined 20 years ago, which is why it must be said tragically that the terrorists succeeded beyond their dreams in inflicting damage on this country. Do you see some of that with some of this crazy bitterness and angry shouting denunciations involving a vaccine?
Yeah, I think I think the crazy was coming upon us before September 11th. I don't want to lay it all at the feet of September 11th, but I think September 11th certainly exacerbated it. I think September 11th, if nothing else, at a minimum, sort of helped to create this world of what I call the misinformation crisis, where there's no such thing as an objective truth, but there are multiple truths, and you have yours, and I have mine, and she has hers, et cetera, which is a frighteningly dangerous place for us to be. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a difference of opinion. Differences of opinion are healthy, and if you can argue yours and persuade me or vice versa, then fine. But if we have a difference in fact, if we are looking at the same white wall and I see blue and you see, you know, purple, or do you see orange or something along those lines, then we have no basis upon which to comment upon the aesthetics of the wall because we're not even seeing what's actually there. And that's the state of things in this country right now with regard to the vaccine and, frankly, with regard to a whole lot of other stuff.
Well, with regard to 9/11, there's a piece in the Washington Post that suggests that about a fourth of Americans still believe there was some kind of governmental conspiracy behind the attacks on September 11th. You have a response to that?
It shouldn't need to be said, but I'll say it anyway, how incredibly stupid that is. Once you get past, you know, two people maybe can keep a secret. But once you get past two people, whatever was a secret is eventually going to come out. And you imagine, you try to imagine for a minute how many people, let's say you and I, we're going to take down this skyscraper. How many people do we have to involve in the planning, you know, the gathering of the materiel?
Yeah, to plant the dynamite in the basement.
Got to plant the dynamite. How many people have to cooperate with us? It's got to be a cast of dozens, if not hundreds. And so it's amazing to me that people believe, after 20 years, that a cast of dozens, if not hundreds, one, decided to betray their country, and two, were able to keep this a secret for 20 years. I think as a nation, and I say this facetiously, but also, you know, with an element of truth, I think we watched too damn much X-Files in the 90s. I really believe this whole sort of idea of the truth is out there kind of infected the body politic in ways that we're still coming to grips with.
I couldn't agree with you more. One of the things I saw this recent thing on Apple that was actually incredibly good. It was called 9/11 Inside the Presidential War Room. And what it showed is just how unprepared they were, how confused. They didn't even know where to land the plane where the president could be safe. They went to Louisiana and then to Omaha, and then Bush wanted to go back to Washington, but he couldn't persuade his security people to allow it. It was totally confused, total chaos, totally unprepared. If Bush had had some role in this, he would have made himself look good, right? If you're going to do a big conspiracy and murder your fellow Americans, you want yourself to look capable. And instead, he, as is made famous by Michael Moore and others, was reading books to children at No Child Left Behind event in Florida. Leonard Pitts, who is also in Florida, not just reading books to children, but educating all of us with his outstanding column, which I often clip, save, and quote. Leonard Pitts of the Miami Herald, Godspeed to you, sir, and a wonderful weekend coming up. We'll be right back.
Americans are going to hear the truth.
The Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved Show, one of the interesting points of follow-up on Leonard Pitts, and I always enjoy talking to Leonard, has to do with some comments that a veteran of the War on Terror, longtime Army officer, who recently commented off the air, and he didn't want to be cited on this. He said, a lot of times I feel like, okay, we've basically won against the terrorists. But then I look around and I see what's going on with the pandemic and the fighting over the pandemic. And I feel, we don't need the terrorists. We're killing each other. And Well, there's another example of that. It's not actual killing, but it's the kind of divisiveness and the stupidity and just the appalling crapola that has infested our country from the right, from the left, and maybe even sometimes from the center. Headline in The Federalist, it says National Archives slaps harmful content warning on Constitution, all other founding documents. You say harmful content in the Constitution? What part of the Constitution is harmful content? We've lived by those words, those precious words, every one of them with meaning and fate attached to it. But okay, here's the story. The National Archives Records Administration, that's NARA, placed a harmful content, that's in quotation marks, warning on the Constitution, labeling the governing document of the United States as harmful or difficult to view. The warning applies to all documents across the archives cataloged website, including the Bill of Rights and that pesky Declaration of Independence as well. Quote, NARA's records span the history of the United States, they wrote, and it is our charge, meaning our duty, to preserve and make available these historical records. As a result, some of the materials presented here may reflect outdated, biased, offensive, and possibly violent views and opinions. In addition, some of the materials may relate to violent or graphic events and are preserved for their historical significance. Wait, we're being told that if they did not have historical significance, other things about violent and graphic events, I mean, does that include some of America's world-saving victories, like in World War II? Does it include victory in the war between the states that freed more than 3 million people? The NARA, National Archives Records Administration, which is responsible for preserving and protecting the documentation of American heritage, noted that so-called harmful historical documents could reflect racist, sexist, ableist, misogynistic, misogynoir, and xenophobic opinions and attitudes, be discriminatory towards or exclude diverse views on sexuality, gender, religion, and more, and include graphic content of historical events such as violent death, medical procedures, crime, wars, terrorist acts, natural disasters, and more. So, is it possible to present history at all? I mean, let alone the history of the United States, history of any country at all, without engaging in some of those mentions of natural disaster, crime, terrorist acts, along with committing to diversity and equity. The NARA said it would work in close conjunction with diverse communities and seek to balance the preservation of this history with sensitivity to how these materials are presented to and perceived by users. Isn't this a little bit nuts? I mean, the land of the free and the home of the brave? They write that this is not the first time the National Archives has catered to a progressive view of history. In June, the National Archives Racism Task Force claimed that the archives rotunda, which houses founding documents, is an example of structural racism because it has white pillars? Is that the problem? The task force also pushed to include trigger warnings around displays of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, which are all displayed in the rotunda. The warning is a blanket statement atop all documents in the archive catalogs that links to a statement on potentially harmful content. Okay, the idea that content that tells the truth about American history is harmful? Well, part of the truth about American history that is particularly relevant right now has to do with the founders, and guess what? Vaccines. We've talked on the on this show before about how George Washington was an early advocate of vaccines for the Continental Army back in 1778. It was one of the reasons that helped him win the Revolutionary War. The only vaccine that people used at that time or knew anything about was smallpox. And Washington had suffered smallpox when he was 14 years old. His skin was actually, I mean, people could notice. He tried to get people not to notice by putting powder sometimes on his skin. But he had some of the pockmarks left over from smallpox all his life. A lot of people believe that his bout with smallpox may have been why he was never able, despite his great desire to do so, to have children. The father of our country was childless. He had two stepchildren. Martha had been a widow when they married. In any event, there's a piece in the Boston Globe, and it's an important piece. While COVID-19 Delta variant cases and rise in cities like Washington and Los Angeles return to mask mandates, many Americans remain persistently divided about the best tool we have to leave such measures behind us, vaccines. The unifying example the founders set almost 250 years ago, when a deadlier disease required riskier measures, should serve as a model for today. By inoculating themselves then, they may have saved the Republic. General George Washington was fighting two foes when the Continental Army encamped at Valley Forge, the British and the smallpox. Washington had seen the disease devastate American troops during the Quebec campaign, and he knew that the revolution would be dead in its cradle if his own troops fell ill. So America's future first president got his command inoculated in our first such large-scale government-led campaign. Washington's action saved his army to fight another day. Now, this was not a president of the United States ordering it. It was a general. Any general ordered it not for people in general, but for people serving in the army. This is 2 years later. It actually, there's more. We will get to it, involving James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, and others who saw among our founders the great value of vaccinations, and yes, of vaccination mandates. There's also the idea that somehow it is tyrannical and it is offensive that the United States is now pushing some vaccine mandates. The a list of countries' vaccine mandates: Australia, Britain, Canada, Fiji, okay, not a very important country, France, yes, a very important country, Greece, Indonesia, Italy, Hungary, Kazakhstan, thank you, Borat, Lebanon, Malta, Micronesia, if it's good enough for Micronesia, Poland, Russia, of course, their vaccine, we don't even know if it works. Saudi Arabia, Sri Lanka, Turkmenistan, and the United States. And that just beginning now. What does it mean? Where do we go? How do we get out of all of it? And what do we do to continue prosecuting and hopefully winning, by keeping us safe, the ongoing war on terror? We'll talk about that with Andy McCarthy and more coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.